Hi, I'm Batsheva Frankel from Overthrowing Education, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Digital citizenship does a decent job with social emotional wellness, but I do think it may not necessarily tackle like the emotional impact of the media that we're exposed to.
Welcome to the Leader of Learning podcast. This is where educators can come to find inspiration to transform education through effective leadership. I'm your host, Dr. Dan Krynas, and my research and leadership experiences have led me to understand that someone like you, regardless of your role or your title, can truly make an impact in your organization. I chat with amazing guests who epitomize what it truly means to be a leader of learning. I'm so glad you've tuned in. Let's get started. Hey, Leader of Learning, and welcome to episode 128. This is going to be a great one, but before we get there, I still just want to remind you to please go ahead, and if you haven't yet, subscribe or follow this podcast on whatever your favorite app to listen to podcasts is. If you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, hit that follow button. If you're on anything else, go ahead and subscribe so that way you are notified every time new episodes come out. And I'd also love it if you could subscribe to the Leader of Learning YouTube channel. Links are in the show notes, as well as if you go to YouTube and search for Dr. Dan Krynas or Leader of Learning, you're sure to find us on there. Now, episode 128. This is going to be a great one. In this episode, I had a conversation with good friend and digital wellness expert Kerry Gallagher, and I was really interested to get Kerry's thoughts on everything from digital wellness versus digital citizenship, how technology and social media has affected our students, especially during the pandemic, how parents can help their students through navigating digital wellness and also social media. And I kind of had a selfish reason to ask because I have a sixth grade son who's getting into it, and I just wanted to know for myself. But I think you can benefit from a lot of that conversation. And we wrap up talking about how parents and schools can better partner together for some of this work around digital wellness. I really can't wait for you to listen. Coming up after these messages is my interview with Kerry Gallagher. Welcome back, Leader of Learning. I'm excited to bring on a guest who, I don't know if she knows this. I think I've tried or I've been wanting to bring her on the show for a while, and I think this is going to be a very timely topic, so I'm excited to bring on Kerry Gallagher. We've only met up really once or twice, I think, but friend and fellow ASCD emerging leader and an expert in the area of digital wellness. So I'm excited to talk about that. Kerry's an assistant principal. Correct me if I'm wrong. So Kerry, welcome to the show. And that was a very brief introduction, but if you could fill us more in on who you are, where you are, and what you do.
Sure. So my role at my school, which is an independent school for boys in Massachusetts. We serve grade 6 through 12. We have about 1,500 boys at our school. We have a very large campus with lots of buildings on it. So my role is assistant principal for teaching and learning. So it's a lot more like an assistant superintendent role at a small district. My role is to help with technology integration, instructional coaching, year one and two teacher induction, professional learning, I partner with our IT department to make sure our teachers have both the equipment and the support that they need to, you know, be able to reach their students, whether they're near or far, and to deliver really powerful, impactful lessons and learning experiences with our students. So, and then the one other role I have is I serve as education director for an internet safety nonprofit called Connect Safely, which is based in Palo Alto, California. And so the combination and overlap of those two roles leads to that passion for digital wellness that you talked about, Dan, that you and I have had the opportunity to talk about in person a couple of times.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like your role at school is, I think, pretty similar to mine, just with the AP title and I guess some more administrative duties. And I don't know if you're familiar with my story. I've told it here on the podcast recently. It's kind of one of the reasons why I left an assistant principal role a couple of months ago, because I wanted to get back to doing more of what you and I get to do, which is really handle more of the instruction and the technology and all the things that I think we're a little more passionate about. But I do want to talk to you about the digital wellness. And so I guess I'm just going to lead in by having you tell us what the work is around, and really when it comes to what Connect Safely does, I guess, if you can just explain a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I transitioned from the term digital citizenship that I think a lot of our colleagues are more familiar with to the terminology of digital wellness about 2 years ago. And the reason for that is I think the common understanding of digital citizenship is that it relates to how we behave when we're online, whether we are our true selves, how we treat others, basically ensuring that like you are the same person and that you are kind of leaving the internet a better place than you left it. All of these are incredibly valuable and important pursuits. But about 2 years ago, I felt as though it was leaving behind some really important concerns that I was hearing from the children I serve, from the parents of those children, and from the teachers that I serve. And the areas that I thought it was leaving behind was how our technology use is impacting our cognition, like our thinking and our learning. How it was impacting our physical wellness. So that means things like sleep and even our eye health, and how much time we're spending on screens with our eyes, and even our ear health with, you know, how much and what volume we're using our AirPods or our earbuds, right? So then finally, I think digital citizenship does a decent job with social emotional wellness, but I do think it may not necessarily tackle like the emotional impact of the media that we're exposed to. We maybe talk a little bit about media literacy and the ability to process and find truth, right, over fact, over opinion and things like that. But there's also a wellness side of that needs to be addressed. So that's why I started moving in the direction of wellness, so that we were able to kind of address all of those concerns that parents were trying to navigate with the children that they care for, and that teachers were trying to navigate with the children that present in front of them in the classroom.
I really like so much of what you spoke about when you basically defined the term digital wellness and then spoke about how you like it more than digital citizenship, because that I think is the one that has become more trendy and more popular still across education. And, you know, even in my district, I don't want to say we're behind the times. I'm sure we're not the only ones, but we're still trying to develop a digital citizenship curriculum after really only going one-to-one with devices over the last couple of years, and certainly during the pandemic with remote learning, but we're still not even there yet. Here's what I really wanted to ask you about, and I'm just going to kind of jump right into it with you, if you don't mind. When we got back this year, as an assistant principal, especially dealing with discipline, I felt this a lot, but I think teachers would all agree as well. And I'm guessing your school is much the same. Kids, in a way, felt different. I don't know exactly why. It's been very hard for me personally to put my finger on why. But I heard so many people quick to blame the fact that students had to be on devices so much, whether it was during school for remote learning, or the fact that they had an excuse because they were home so much more to be on other devices like video games and social media. And I really want to know from you, because I do trust your expert opinion here, is there validity to that? Do we feel like students have changed now because of what they've gone through the last couple of years as it relates to technology and access to technology?
So I think that the access to technology and the need for our leaning on technology over the last year and a half has led to, you know, a different student with different strengths and struggles in our classrooms. I also want to highlight that every year the students that present in front of us are different than the ones the year before, and that, you know, the fact that they're different this year as compared to last year or 2019, they were different in 2019 than they were in 2018 or 2017, right? And so annually I hear teachers talk about, oh, kids aren't the way they used to, right? They can't, you know, write the way they used to be able to write. They can't, I don't know. They don't pay attention the same way they do to activities that used to always work for me. And so that is not a new challenge for teachers, that we're having to shift to the way we teach things or the way we explain things, because the students who are in front of us are being raised in a world that's constantly changing. And so their strengths and struggles are going to constantly change. I think what has escalated the way educators feel about it is that they are also feeling kind of anxious about the changes. And they are also trying to navigate, you know, what their home and work life looks like with their own children and their own patterns. And maybe they're feeling bad about the amount of time they're spending on screens. And so there's a little bit of projecting, like feeling bad about the amount of time the children they serve are spending on screens. So I think those are some of all of the different nuances that are at play. That being said, we have actually had the opportunity to survey some of our students about where their struggles are this year as compared to previous years. And what we're hearing overwhelmingly from the adolescents, because we serve grades 6 through 12, so it's primarily that adolescent sweet spot, is they are struggling with maintaining their attention throughout an entire class period. So a 45 to 60 minute class period, it's hard for them to stay at attention for that whole time. And maybe they're even willing to admit that it's harder for them to do that than it used to be. And that probably is because of pandemic teaching and learning, because in many cases, they were attending classes from home. Maybe it was asynchronous, and so they had the flexibility to take breaks when they wanted to, whereas under a normal school bell schedule, you know, they don't have that same flexibility. And so it's hard for them to maintain that on-demand attention versus attention on their own schedule. So yes, I think the pandemic has, and screens have something to do with that. I think we have to be careful, though, not to blame the technology for the areas of growth for our children, right? They are a product of the structures and environments that they were in. And that environment does include, for sure, technology. So that's a part of the equation. But it also includes the habits of the adults that they're watching and what those adults are modeling for them. It also includes, you know, the values that are not just being talked about, but are being lived out, right, in their school communities. So I think we need to take technology as one of the factors, but not the factor. It's very easy to blame the technology, but it's also important to note that the technology can be a great solution to some of the concerns that we have. So I'm certainly not here to say that, you know, technology is the answer or that technology isn't to blame, but it is one of the things. It isn't the thing in on both sides of that coin.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's valid. I think that some teachers may be, some educators may be a little too quick to blame technology, but, you know, it's kind of stealing words out of your mouth. I think it does come down to the fact that just each year and periodically throughout our careers as educators, we do maybe need to take a step back and say students are going to be different, whether it's every year or every few years, and we need to adapt and adjust. I have another big question for you pertaining to parenting and digital wellness, as you call it. But I wanted to kind of ask a follow-up question, because related to that idea of how educators can adapt and you know, really basically grow themselves as these students change, like literally in front of them every so often. What is it that we need to adjust to and adapt to, and how can we do that? And I'll give you an example. I think that no one knew how to handle, and if you did, or you know of someone who did, I'd love to hear it. Like earlier this year, when all of the TikTok challenges were going around, that was new, right? Like educators had not really faced something like that before. I don't know about, I know you and I don't live too far away. I'm in Connecticut, you're in Mass, but here, there was like a nationwide TikTok challenge where it was supposed to be kids coming to their school with weapons and maybe shooting. And it was, nobody proved that was gonna happen, but like a lot of schools were on guard for something to happen. And so I think these are some of the realities. Like, how do we adjust to that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think there's always going to be something like that we as educators are going to have to work hard and partner with parents to communicate a common message with our children about, hey, we know this trend is out there. We're grateful that you're willing to talk with us about it and share with us that it's happening. And let's work together on making sure that the negative impact of this trend is not going to affect the community that you identify with, right? So I think the larger conversation is about what are the values that the children that you serve associate themselves with? Are they proud to be from where they're from? And how can they make sure that they will continue to be proud to be from that place, you know, as they grow and learn? Does that mean that they won't make mistakes? Of course they'll make mistakes, right? And of course some of them will kind of fall into those trends. I think it's to be expected. I tend to have, as an assistant principal, we have deans who really deal with the discipline side of things at my school. But as an assistant principal, sometimes I have the opportunity to take part in some sort of, you know, post-discipline conversations with some of the boys at our school. And I say boys because we are a boys' school, about the choices that they've made and the impact that it's had right now. And maybe when a choice like that presents in the future, like what might they be able to do differently? And I think what I would say is the kids know the right answers to say when they're asked those questions by adults. So I want to caution adults when you have those conversations, you know, they know the answer is block or don't respond or tell an adult, right? So once you move past those rote answers that they know, get down to the real stuff with them. Like, okay, that's great. Like, I know you know the right answers. But really, really, when you're feeling pressured, you know, like, who are you actually going to tell? And really, really, when you're feeling emotional and anxious, what activities can you do when you're really upset about something to help you calm down? Like, I had a conversation with a boy today who said, you know what, the best thing for me to do is either to listen to music or go for a bike ride. And I was like, then that's what you should do. Like, you, when you are noticing that you're emotional, whether it's anger or frustration or sadness or feeling excluded, rather than yelling at somebody or posting something on TikTok that you're going to regret later, maybe you should just grab your bike and go for a little bit and then come back and, you know, then figure out whether you're going to tell an adult or scroll past it. Or maybe it's actually not time for you to make those decisions until you're able to kind of calm yourself down. And I think that's that, you know, we can't prevent everything as adults, Dan, but I think what we can do is consistently have conversations with our children about the values that they have so that when they're presented with that temptation or that trend, they can apply those values to that situation. There's no way for us to be able to predict future trends or situations, but we can have meaningful, you know, repetitive conversations with our children about how they want to be identified, how they want to be known, you know, what makes them proud in terms of their identity and how they can ensure that they stay loyal to that no matter what trend presents itself to them.
That kind of is a nice natural segue into the bigger questions again that I wanted to ask you. And I guess really the first one is, well, I think you answered part of it just now in terms of how educators and parents can start to really address this idea of digital wellness with kids, with students. I really did want to jump into more of the parenting and also the partnership between parent and school aspect here, because you and I are both parents. I think your kids are a little bit older than mine, but I have a sixth grade son now, and he's starting to get into, he's definitely into video games, but he's starting to get into YouTube and some of the social media. And so I'm living this as a parent and as an educator too, to really try and teach kids the right way to do things and being responsible. I love the way you just put it as like an identity. Like, how do you identify what do you want to put out to the world? And so I guess the first part of the question is like, for parents specifically, where do we start and how do we do some of that? And then also, and I'll remind you if you forget, the second part of the question is really how can we partner as parents and schools together to do this? Because to be honest, I don't necessarily see that happening. And I think that's one of the most frustrating parts for teachers and administrators alike. It's like, we're trying to do our thing. Probably parents are trying to do their thing, but just doesn't seem like we're on the same page. So the first part of the question is like, from the parent perspective, where do we start and where do we go from there?
Sure. A lot of times when schools or districts bring me in to work on digital parenting with parenting groups, this is like the big question, right? Like, and the form that it takes from parent audiences, Dan, is when's the right age? Is it okay for me to give my kid a phone? Mm-hmm. And really, they want me to tell them an age so that they know when it's okay for them to give their kid a phone and still be considered a good parent, right? And not be the one who's known in the community as like the one who gave their kid a phone too early.
And I'm not asking you to like out yourself here. I will just share that with my 11-year-old sixth grade son. He just got, quote unquote, his own phone within the last couple of months, but it's really Wi-Fi only. It's not tied to a cell phone plan. What it has on it is an app that allows him to have a phone number so he can text and call, but only when he's on Wi-Fi. So really only in our house or someone else's house where they have a Wi-Fi connection. So right now, that has allowed us to kind of ease our way into, you know, extending that responsibility to him. So that's just what we decided to do.
Yeah, and I've taken a slightly different approach in terms of which devices at which ages and all of that stuff, but I think you and I have a similar mindset in terms of training wheels, right? So it isn't that, and I think there's like the wait till eighth movement, because that's when most children tend to turn 13, or they will have turned 13 in seventh grade. And so, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act is the law that has created this like artificial age 13 gateway for when social media is okay for humans, which, by the way, has nothing to do with their maturity or ability to handle social media. It is entirely based on when we've decided we want to allow companies access to our children's private data. So for your audience, that doesn't mean that they're mature magically at 13. It just means that the government has decided it's okay for companies to have access to your child's information at age 13. So you can make your own decision about when that's okay. You don't have to rely on that law. I will tell you that my children had access to their own devices much, much younger than what you're talking about, because I decided to give them access to, a device does not equal phone, to devices that were designed for children at various ages, where I had parent dashboards available to me so that I could manage both the content that they were accessing, at what times and how long they were accessing it. And also we were able to have consistent conversations starting from when they were as young as pre-K about, you know, how we use devices as a family, what values we have around them. We did a lot of co-viewing and co-playing on devices so that we could talk about what we were doing and why we were making those choices. And so those took the form of tablets. They took the form of smartwatches. We also, that way we could talk a little bit about some of the fitness and health and tracking apps that are a part of wearables. And I would say that 5 years ago, my opinion on the proper age to give a child a phone is very different than it is now. And that's because the companies that design the phones have actually improved a great deal how much parents are able to manage their own child's devices. So I actually, like what I have done for my oldest, who is not that much older than yours, she's in seventh grade, and what I have chosen to do for my youngest are different, just based on the features that are available in the 3 years in their age gap. But I would say it's interesting that your son is, you know, he's been in gaming for a while and he's just getting into social media now. I would tell you girls hit that much younger than sixth grade. So,
especially when you have a younger daughter who really looks up to her older brother, I think we're definitely in trouble. But, you know, one of the things that's allowed me as a parent to, like you said, training wheels to ease my son into, especially the social media, is lately I've sort of integrated and used his passion for gaming with essentially some practice in terms of, again, that identity, like what he wants to put out there. So, you know, he sees me doing this podcast and having a relatively successful YouTube channel. And so he has a Google account, and so therefore he has a YouTube channel, and he's actually put some stuff out on it. But I'm working with him to edit and essentially produce, you know, the quality content that goes out there. And but he's pretty into it, and I've enjoyed doing that with him, for the fact that he and I get to do it together, but also because I know that in a lot of ways it is training him to create his own kind of digital identity, digital footprint, and practice some of that digital wellness.
I could just say one thing about social media in particular, because it sounds like you're very early in that with your son, and I have a little bit of time now with my daughter who's in seventh grade, is if your child is asking for a social media account from a certain platform, it's really important that as a parent you create an account for yourself first, and that there's a couple of options here. You can sit side by side with your child and have them show you the platform and show you, because I guarantee if they want it, they've already had contact with it through their friends, so they already know how to use it. So you can have them show you, or create your own account and then hop on YouTube and watch a bunch of videos about how to use it and learn to do it yourself, or learn to do it alongside your child. I would trend toward platforms that enable you to create an account that is for your child that you're permitted to supervise. So for instance, both of my children, long before they were 13, had a Facebook Messenger Kids account that I could supervise. I can control their contacts. And for my youngest, who doesn't have a phone yet, that's the way she does like video chats with her friends. And that's because the parents of those friends and myself have connected, given each other our children's codes, and decided that we want our children to be able to connect that way. And so that's adults making decisions for them. It's always been prompted by our kids asking for that. But that's great, because then I already have the contact information of that parent. The other one is, and I know it's a very controversial platform because of what you, one reason is the trend you just talked about, but TikTok is actually one of the platforms that allows parents to create and supervise their children's accounts. And so that's one that was kind of the next step forward in terms of training wheels for my older daughter before we moved on to some of the other places where I can't supervise, like Snapchat and others. And she only moved on to those once she had proven that she could be responsible under that supervision. And we had already kind of set the tone of like, we talk a lot about what happens on your social media, so just be ready for me to ask. Or if you don't want me asking you, you should voluntarily start sharing information with me without me even prompting. And that's worked really well for us. I think the key thing to training wheels, Dan, and I know you get this, is that it can't be like, all right, these are the training wheels, you have to prove yourself and then I'll let up. As a parent, you have to hold up your end of the bargain and actually let up over time, right? You can't just keep it restricted for 3 years. If they're earning it, you have to prove to them that they're earning it. And that will build trust between you and them. So I think it's important for us parents to kind of hold up that end of the bargain with them.
That's some really awesome advice. You know, similarly, we did some of those things that you're mentioning. My son has asked for TikTok and he doesn't have his own yet, but I got it maybe within the last couple months, really, just to familiarize myself more with it. I do understand, like you say, that's one of the platforms that does allow parents to have more, I don't want to say control, but just
supervision.
Yeah, I guess.
Not so.
Yeah, supervision. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's really great advice. I actually also wanted to shout out an app that we haven't really used it too much recently, but we used to use it. It's literally called Screen Time. And it's similar to how we have my son usually uses PlayStation for gaming, or also Nintendo Switch. They have parental controls. And so it's similar to that, where, like you said before, you can not only monitor what apps are being used, not so much, you can't really look too much into the content that they're viewing or that they're going to, but you could definitely check in on the screen time and limit it. And you could even shut down the whole device at a certain time when that time limit is reached. It was actually really, it was really helpful for us when we were using it more actively. So I do want to end, though, if you could maybe just advise about, because I think this is, again, I think this is the piece we're missing that we're still really trying to desperately work toward, is that partnership between schools and families, not just when it comes to like, I'm a parent and I call my school's administrator and be like, look, they're, you know, being cyber bullied, or they're some other kids sexting, or, you know, but like a true partnership between what is being taught and how things are being handled in schools and what parents and kids are actually seeing and doing at home.
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, to go back to one thing you said before, if your family lives in the Apple environment, I do agree screen time is wonderful and they're always improving it. And that's one of the reasons I'm willing to give my younger daughter a phone earlier than my older daughter had a phone, because of the level of control and oversight that's there that I can gradually let up on. For families that are not in the Apple environment, for Droids or the Google environment, they have Family Link and it's equally wonderful. Mm-hmm. So either there is no right answer. It's just a matter of kind of learning how to use those environments. And I use both, because my children both have Apple devices and Chromebooks. And so, and I can just sing the praises of both as being wonderful foundations for conversations that I've had with my children, where they've, for instance, requested access to certain apps or asked for more time or any of those things. And those conversations have been really helpful. So when it comes to partnership with the schools, I would say it's really incumbent on the school to create a community environment where parents feel as though they can come to the school and the school isn't going to make them feel like they don't know anything, right? So I think it's important to have not just programming where you bring in an expert, like schools bring me in all the time for parent programming. And I really value that time with parents. But the best thing that schools get out of it is that I survey the parents before I meet with them so that I get to know the top questions that parents have. And then I, you know, tailor my programming with the research and resources and tools, some of the tools that we've mentioned that will really meet their needs. But then I share that survey data with the school. And then the school has that information as like the next step forward to figure out how to continue communicating with parents. Like if the biggest concern that parents have is gaming, let's start having conversations with the students about which kind of games they like to play, what's happening when they're gaming. Let's encourage students, for instance, in an English class to do a creative writing assignment about a gaming situation that happens among friends, and allow that to provide some insights for us, and then, you know, go from there. Let's have, you know, before the school year starts, have, you know, like late summer or beginning of the school year programming with parents. So you can say like, here's how your son or daughter is going to use a Chromebook in our class. So here are some questions you can ask them instead of just how was your day at school? Like, you know, did you use, ST Math today? Did you use iReady today? What did you do in that program? And, you know, when you think about like IXL and ST Math and iReady and all of these different programs, which ones do you like the most? Which ones do you not like so much? Why is that, right? Like, those are great questions that can make the help the parents feel more empowered to know exactly how their child is using technology at school and be able to have more of a two-way conversation. That, I think, builds trust among parents and the school. And then when a problematic situation arises, the parent feels more comfortable calling up the school and saying, so, you know, he or she was doing, you know, an iReady assignment, and then this message popped up. He got really upset. This is, you know, kind of what happened. You know, I don't want to point fingers and say this other child was doing a wrong thing and my child was not, but clearly there's something more behind this interaction, and I would really appreciate the school's like partnership on this. And I think that conversation is more likely to start in a much calmer place than if the school hadn't built that relationship, because if they hadn't built that relationship, the parent's going to be like, my kid's being bullied, right? Because they don't know how much intention is behind all of the technology use that's happened in school, unless the school has been transparent about that intention.
That's a good point. Just before we go, I'm kind of putting you on the spot for a second. I am interested in your opinion here, and this is just your opinion, I think. But when it comes to personal devices, and namely phones for students in school, how much is enough? How much is too much? And at what ages, in your opinion?
Like So when you say in school, what do you, just to help me understand?
Like, I think that one of the biggest questions on parents' minds and even educators too is like, kids, a lot of kids have phones, right? And if we're talking about, like, you work in a 6-12 environment. I was in a 6-12 school earlier this year. Now I'm in, you know, just middle school, but most of those kids have phones. Should they be bringing them to school? If they are, should they be using them in school? When, how much, you know, that kind of thing.
So I think if a family chooses to give their child a phone, there's probably reason behind it that is connected somehow to family communication. So I don't think that we should be telling families that their children cannot bring their phones to school, especially if we want children to have the flexibility to maybe, you know, I want to stay for anime club today. I've never stayed for this club today, but my friend said he's going to go and I think it would be really fun. Wouldn't it be great if, because that kid has a phone, he can text his mom and say, I'm going to stay for this club. And then you have that kid more engaged in his school community than he's ever been before, because that's the day, because of that opportunity, right? So I think if we make these blanket rules prohibiting phones, we're failing to see the potential opportunities that can come from those communications. I do think it makes sense, though, for schools to have students keep those phones like in lockers or cubbies or something during the school day, because if the parent needs to reach the child, they can call the school and the adults in the school will get the information, especially if it's really important or an emergency to the child. And they will actually manage the communication of that information in a way that will allow the child to handle it well and not just be something that pops up on his phone while he's in class in math and not expecting it and maybe emotionally won't handle it as well, right? So I don't think it's a problem for them to bring their phone to school, especially as they're handling like the coming and going from school, potentially changing of plans. What if I want to go to my friend's house? Is that okay? You know, I think all of that, like they have lives outside of the 55 minutes we spend with them in each class, right? So let's acknowledge that and acknowledge that using phones to communicate those kind of family schedules is just a natural part of life. But I do think it's okay to ask them to leave those personal devices, you know, put away during the actual school day when their focus is on academics, because most schools at this point provide the devices that children need because of the pandemic. So they are one-to-one with Chromebooks or one-to-one with, you know, tablets or whatever device that they need. So that's my take on it. I don't want to make a family feel judged for feeling as though their child needs a phone at an age that's younger than the age that my family has chosen, because their circumstances are different than mine.
Sure. Yeah, no, well said. I appreciate your time. You know, if nothing else, I got a lot out of this as both an educator and especially as a parent of a kid who's, you know, becoming that kind of age where phones and electronics and social media is really becoming a much more important and bigger part of his life. So I really appreciate everything you said. I know the listeners are still going to get a lot out of this too. So before you go, just tell us where people can find you if they want more information or to connect with you, social media, website, and also plug the work that you're doing with Connect Safely.
So,
yeah, that's what I thought. I'm sorry about
so
that.
That's okay. So you can find Connect Safely at connectsafely.org, and it's all one word, connectsafely.org. We also have an annual event that's pretty big that we put a lot of time and planning into called Safer Internet Day. It's coming up the first Tuesday in February, and you can find out more about that at saferinternetday.us. Or, you know, there'll be links to it coming soon on connectsafely.org. This year we have lesson plans and we have a whole library of videos that we've been working hard to produce the last 2 months that I'm really excited to release to parents and educators. So pay attention for that. If this episode is coming out at the end of January, it may already be out by the time our listeners are hearing this. If not, it will be coming soon. If you're looking to find me personally and you'd like to know a little bit about some of the devices and platforms that I hinted at, or would like to connect with me to work with your family or your school community, you can find me at kerryhawk02@gmail.com. So that's kerryhawk02@gmail. And that is also my handle on all of the social media. So Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, everywhere. And you can find me, follow me, and DM me on those platforms.
Excellent. Again, very much appreciate all of the information you shared, the advice that you've given, and just your knowledge about all things digital wellness. That's definitely a term that I'm going to use more often now, more often than digital citizenship, maybe. Anyway, Carrie, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and connect with your audience. I appreciate it.
Well, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't done so yet, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. Also, if you enjoy the content shared on the show, please recommend this podcast to other educators, leaders, friends, or anyone you think would love listening and learning. I would also appreciate it if you would leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or whatever podcast app you use to listen. For more information about me or this show, head over to leaderoflearning.com. While you're there, you can also find the Leader of Learning blog, how to connect on social media such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Voxer, sign up for our newsletter, and even find out how to purchase Leader of Learning merchandise. Thanks again, and remember, no matter who you are or where you are, you too can be a leader of learning.